Hello, everyone. Welcome to Personal Investing. I'm Bob McKeever for the Virginia Voice. Today on Personal Investing, we're going to have a heavy dose of perspective and human behavior. So let's get started with our first article, the title of which is Today's Route Looks a Bit Like the Financial Crisis, a look at what they have in common and what they don't. And it's written by Reshma Kapadia for Barron's. Investors have been grasping for some sort of framework by which to compare the market route stoked by the coronavirus outbreak. On Monday, the 11th anniversary of the bull market, they got it, 2008. While it may not be a perfect comparison, strategists are now pointing to the deep downturn during 2008 for clues as to where the markets today will go, and warning value stocks may not be the place for a tactical shift. Instead, many prefer companies with strong balance sheets. Markets globally tumbled Monday with coronavirus concerns exacerbated by Saudi Arabia launching an oil price war. The S&P 500 opened down 7%, briefly halting trade. As confirmed coronavirus cases outside of China tripled in the past week, and the U.S. began grappling with how to deal with the outbreak, strategists started preparing for their worst-case scenarios to become the baseline, even as a lot remained unknown. For the most part, strategists aren't looking to jump in yet for bargains. We're looking for 2008 levels of market fear to tell us the bottoming process has begun, and we expect that window will be shorter than the financial crisis, writes Nicholas Kolos, co-founder of DataTrek Research. In a note to clients, Neil Shearing, chief economist at Capital Econometrics, wrote that 2008 was a financial shock that hit demand, whereas the coronavirus shock is one that is hitting both demand and supply, and that means it is likely to play out differently. As a result, he expects a sharp economic hit that will play out more like a recession than a depression. While the 2008 crisis created a deep recession and a slow recovery, as both households and financial firms had to heal their balance sheets, the virus is likely to spark sharp drops in output in the affected economies over the next quarter. But as long as the virus fades, activity should bounce back as supply constraints are eased. In other words, Shearing writes, expect a short, sharp shock. Typically, fiscal and monetary stimulus work by boosting demand, but today the problem lies with both supply and demand. Loans and subsidies to the hardest-hit companies, targeted temporary and large fiscal support, could offset the shock, and central bankers could ease credit troubles with cheap financing to banks to the worst-hit companies. But the speed of the recovery is predicated largely on how the virus spreads and how life returns to normal, he notes. Asset price collapses have historically triggered severe depressions in the past. In 2008, high levels of leverage in the banking system and other vulnerabilities in the global financial system, such as a dependence on wholesale finance and short-term credit lines, magnified the situation, Shearing notes. The good news, though debt levels are high, they are concentrated in the government rather than households, and thus less risky, and banks are better capitalized. The pockets of vulnerabilities are not big enough to trigger a global crisis, Shearing says. The biggest risk, beyond the immediate coronavirus, is likely what the Japanification of more of the developed economies means, where more countries get stuck in a rut of anemic growth and perpetually low interest rates. Interest rate cuts made to combat this crisis could push more investors to reach for yield, eventually causing bubbles to inflate, thus sowing the seeds of the next major crisis, he warns. Shearing's outlook is the kind that has investors rushing to find some safety, but most low-volatility stocks are trading at premiums that are making them unattractive to some. And while value stocks sometimes do well out of market routes, strategists aren't so sure this time. Better positioned might be strong balance sheet companies. In a note to clients, Indigo Fraser Jenkins, co-head of portfolio strategy at Bernstein Research, gives two reasons it is hard to make a case for a tactical shift to value. The biggest value sectors are banks and energy, both of which face severe challenges as interest rates tumble, credit risks rise, and oil prices plummet. Fraser Jenkins says large-cap energy stocks could become a core part of an income strategy, but in the medium term rather than the short term. While many investors flock to low-volatility stock because they tend to do well as earnings growth turns negative, Fraser Jenkins cautions that these stocks tend to reverse quickly as earnings growth bottoms. Plus, in the U.S., low-volatility stocks are expensive and highly linked to short-term bond yield moves. With the quality of corporate credit at its lowest point in two decades, and balance sheet quality not priced into the stock market the way other quality measures are, Fraser Jenkins favors stocks of companies with good balance sheet quality. Plus, companies with strong balance sheets in the U.S. and Europe aren't expensive, with relative valuations around the middle of their post-1997 historic range, a relatively inexpensive entry point for investors seeking protection from the market rout. Electronic Arts, symbol EA, Alphabet, symbol GOOG, Procter & Gamble, symbol PG, Walmart, symbol WMT, Biogen, symbol BIIB, NVIDIA, symbol NVDA, Visa, symbol V, and Accenture, symbol ACN, are among the U.S. company Bernstein listed as having a sector-neutral, low leverage, and high credit ratings, as well as an outperform rating. And the lesson is, not everything that was safe last time will be safe this time. And that was today's route looks a bit like the financial crisis, a look at what they have in common and what they don't. Written by Reshma Kapadia for Barron's. And next, the Dow will bounce back. History tells us when. Written by Al Root, who writes for Barron's. There is an old adage on Wall Street, the market goes up the escalator and down the elevator. Stock gains tend to be small, relatively steady things, accumulating over years. Stock declines, on the other hand, can be violent, painful affairs. History shows sell-offs are a way of life on Wall Street, testing the mettle of the most seasoned traders. More often than not, history also shows it's a good idea to buy the dip, although executing on that advice can be easier said than done, perhaps especially when the dips are more like a roller coaster drop, like the 12.4% fall in the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the week of ending February 28th. The Dow has existed for 6,200 weeks. And in that time, the index has declined more than 10% in 1 week just 17 times, less than 0.3% of the time. The good news for investors is that after those rare events, stocks have had a tendency to rise in the ensuing 4 week and 6 month periods. The average gain in the 4 weeks after a sell-off is 1.1%. The average gain 6 months later is about 7.5%. Those might not seem like big gains, but investors do get paid for stepping in and buying in times of turmoil. The average gain for any 4 week period over the Dow's history is 0.5%. The average gain for any 6 month period is 3.5%. More risk nets more reward. That's not the whole story, though. While stocks do have a tendency to garner above average gains after a 10% drop in a week, the market only rises in about 55% of the 4-week and 6-month periods after a sell-off. In fact, investors can expect to make money in roughly 60% of any of the 4-week and 6-month periods in the Dow's long history. That's a little disappointing. So buying the dip isn't a sure thing, but there are some factors to keep in mind. For starters, it appears big dips beget more big dips. So investors can expect more volatility. That's one implication of recent trading action. Volatility clustering helps investors in this case. 9 of the 17 episodes of 10% or greater weekly declines happened in the 1930s. The Great Depression, it turns out, was truly depressing. Excluding the 1930s, the average gain for 4-week and 6-month periods following a sell-off is 1.9% and 22.8% respectively. Those are attractive returns. And if investors believe that the coronavirus won't push the global economy into another depression, they can be heartened by the fact that the market rose in 75% of the periods excluding the 1930s. But investors should also be wary of small sample sizes. There are only 8 10% plus dips to consider outside of the 1930s. 2 happened in 1914, while another occurred in 1917. 2 more bracketed the 1930s, in 1929 and 1940. The market fell more than 10% once in 1987 and in 2008. No one knows what will happen this time, but history could perhaps strengthen the resolve of aggressive traders debating whether or not to jump into the market now. The coronavirus is reminiscent of 1990 in terms of stock market effect, wrote Stifel head of institutional equity strategy Barry Bannister, referring to the year Iraq invaded Kuwait. A short, sharp, out-of-the-blue shock that, after the fact, proved to have been painful but economically overrated. There wasn't a 10% weekly decline in 1990. There was, however, a 7.8% decline, and the market dropped 6 straight weeks around the August occupation. Gains started in July, and the market started dropping then, too. Apparently, financial markets knew the invasion was coming. The Fed had been cutting rates since June of 1989. But accelerated the cuts in July of 1990, Bannister added. The S&P 500 rallied back to the old high by February of 1991. Bannister's historical example of a wartime recovery isn't quite the same as a pandemic, but many events have knocked the Dow down, and more often than not, it bounces back quickly. And that was The Dow Will Bounce Back, History Tells Us When, written by Al Root for Barron's. And our next article is also written by Al Root, who we've already heard from once today. The Dow dropped 2,000 points because oil and coronavirus are big problems. How to handle the Knightian stress, and that's spelled K-N-I-G-H-T-I-A-N, and we'll explain Mr. Knight in a few minutes. And it was also written in Barron's. A new generation of investors is learning an old Wall Street lesson. There's a big difference between uncertainty and risk. Conflating the two terms can lead to big problems. If investors don't sort out which is which in a hurry, they can end up making the wrong decisions in times of significant Knightian stress. Monday qualifies as significantly stressful. Trading in U.S. equities was halted for 15 minutes after the 7% circuit breaker was tripped. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 2,000 points, the largest point decline on record, or 7.8%. The S&P 500 plummeted 7.6%. In typical times, for most traders, as well as many investors, stock market volatility is a substitute for risk. Volatility as risk is a time-tested concept. Looking historically at how stocks trade gives investors a good idea about things such as maximum potential daily losses and portfolio correlations with economic indicators. The problem is, after a 10-plus year bull market, investors can be lulled into a false sense that they have all their risk bases covered. There is much more to managing a portfolio than understanding what can happen to a portfolio when, for instance, a U.S. jobs report is released. Investors need to remember to ask themselves what could happen that hasn't happened yet. Former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld may have put it best when he said there are known unknowns as well as unknown unknowns. On the known unknown side of the equation, there are things investors know they just don't know, such as how many Cybertrucks Tesla will sell. In those cases, investors guess based on history and their guts. They factor all the likely outcomes into what to pay for a Tesla truck. It's a sensible practice. But there are unknown unknowns as well. Those are the things investors never see coming. In technical parlance, this is Knightian uncertainty, named for Frank Knight, an economist who wrote in a 1921 book, Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit. Real uncertainty, according to Knight, isn't measurable like a stock's volatility. Knightian uncertainty reared its ugly head during the 2008-2009 financial crisis. Few predicted the mortgage meltdown. Fewer predicted how people would react when once-in-a-generation events, such as a money market fund breaking the buck after Lehman's bankruptcy, occurred. In 2020, nobody predicted the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak. A production adjustment from Saudi Arabia, on the other hand, which catalyzed Monday's sell-off, was a possibility. That's happened in the past. But what no one saw coming Monday was an oil price war during a viral outbreak. There's no way Saudi Arabia would have done this without coronavirus, Bill Smead of Smead Capital Management tells Barron's. He's not being controversial. His point, this was the maximum point of leverage for the Saudis, the time when their actions could have the greatest effect. Oil demand is falling because no one is driving to work, and no one is flying right now. In what now looks like a prescient post, Kenny & Company strategist Peter Kenny wrote in December that the economy feels like it's growing at a sustainable pace. But something was nagging at him, so he invoked Knightian uncertainty, writing it may pull markets lower yet. Monday, he added, referencing the earlier note, the unprecedented price gyrations last week fueled a very significant escalation in the risk-off trade across the board. His fears were realized, and risk-off is code for panic selling. When investors are worried they might not survive, financially speaking, to fight another day. What investors need to know is during periods of Knightian uncertainty, it takes time to work out the implications of all the previously unforeseen risks. In other words, the sell-off isn't over. Institutional investor sentiment has plunged but remains well above 2018, 2016, 2011, and 2009 lows, wrote RBC head of U.S. equity strategy Lori Kelvacina in a Monday research report. She is watching Commodity Futures Trading Commission of CFTC data about asset manager positioning. The problem for Kelvacina? Managers are still too bullish. This indicator, which is reported weekly, has plunged in the last two updates after hitting a new all-time high on February the 18th. The indicator is just off its highs. Recent trading patterns tell Calvacina all the new risks have not been quantified. Risk pricing makes us think the bottom has yet to be reached, added UBS strategist Stuart Kaiser in a Monday research report. He is looking at the VIX volatility index, bond yields, and gold when thinking about risk pricing. Kaiser, like Calvacina, thinks more pain is coming. High volatility episodes last about 2 months on average. For investors, the important thing to do might be nothing. Don't act rashly. Losses are painful, but what's far worse is selling and watching things recover. Hopefully, understanding that Knightian events happen and how the market deals with them, usually via a brutal, sharp sell-off, can help the anxiety. Bill Smead, for his part, doesn't sound too upset. We got the living daylights kicked out of us. This stinks. It's horrible. We hate it, he says. But it's a temporary phenomenon. He believes, like UBS, most of the pain lasts a couple of months. That's enough time for him to shop for bargains. And that article was titled, The Dow Dropped 2,000 Points Because Oil and Coronavirus Are Big Problems, How to Handle the Knightian Stress. And it was written by Al Root for Barron's. And next, we're going to look at the March 8th issue of the Richmond Times-Dispatch for an article by Chuck Jaffe. And it's titled, With a Sense of Purpose, You Can Keep Your Head. Some people watch horror movies with their eyes closed, at least through the horrific parts. And plenty of people have I-can't-watch moments when the tension ramps up in something as benign as a romantic comedy. A lot of investors know how that feels right now, as they couldn't bear to look at their investment portfolio last month, as the market took a beating that included the single biggest one-day drop in the history of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. In any of those situations, the important part isn't what you miss when you are in the dark, it's what you see and how you react to it when you reopen your eyes. It's relevant to investors right now because with the stock market going through a volatile upheaval over the last 2 weeks, knowing when to look is a personal decision that can have long-lasting consequences. Look at your portfolio at the wrong moment, and you could see paper losses from the peak that are frightening, with the potential to become terrifying. Or the wrong moment might be the one when things have rallied, and you convince yourself that everything will be okay, just before you get kicked in the pants by the next downturn. It's like an odd form of market timing. Except all you are really doing is deciding when to check in on your portfolio with the intention to potentially act on what you see there. Looking at the wrong time can be just as bad as investing at the wrong time. The question that each investor needs to ask is when they are going to see just how a downturn or a rebound has affected them and what they plan to do with the answer. Years ago, investors weren't inundated with stock information. They were more likely to check in on their accounts via a monthly statement in the mail than by calling in to a brokerage office to find out what was going on minute by minute. Today, account information is available on demand, portfolios visible 24/7. The minute someone finds out that the market has, say, dropped 1,000 points, they can be evaluating the carnage in their own portfolio, if they want to. See enough blood in the streets, and you might react differently than if you know there's trouble but can't see the bloody bits and gory details. Last week I mentioned on Money Life with Chuck Jaffe that I don't look at my accounts in the middle of significant market flux. I felt no need or urge to check in as the Dow sank 1,190 points on February 27th. I was certain my portfolio would be down roughly by the amount the same percentage as the market decline. Nothing feels correct about a 10% correction that takes thousands of dollars off your paper net worth. I don't look on heavy motion days because seeing a big swing could change my perspective. I'm not being moved off my long-term strategies by the market, but I don't want to have that faith and conviction tested in the crucible of what feels like a free fall. My long-term investments are staying put no matter what the market does on any given day. No financial expert ever has suggested there might be a good time to panic, so I eliminate the thought and the possibility for any panicky reaction. Any short-term monies or securities I might consider selling are on my watch list, with any decisions prepared in advance, meaning that I have decided on an exit strategy without factoring in the market's volatility. Likewise, if I'm sitting on dry powder looking for buying opportunities, I have been active from the sidelines, identifying my targets and what would motivate me to act. Thus, I might buy if the market's volatility puts something on sale, but the decision was made away from the daily volatility. I heard from audience members who thought I was taking a head-in-the-sand approach, but I disagree. I know enough about where my portfolio stands to not be worried, but head-in-the-sand is fine by me if it is how a long-term investor stays the course amid short-term turmoil. For investors who built their portfolio with a long lens, it's important not to take a close-up through the wrong viewfinder. Keep your sense of purpose, money invested properly to reach long, intermediate, and short-term goals and needs, and you can keep your head, no matter the blood and guts the market is likely to dish out over the coming weeks and months. And that was Chuck Jaffe with his article titled, With a Sense of Purpose, You Can Keep Your Head, from the Sunday, March 8, 2020, Richmond Times-Dispatch. And if you have your plans in place and are not affected by daily moves, we have the next few articles to tell you maybe how to deploy those things. First up, be like Warren Buffett in times like these, and here's how, written by Stephen M. Sears. When fear defines financial markets, remember Warren Buffett. The great investor once said the secret to beating the market was to be fearful when others are greedy, and greedy when others are fearful. It's a simple idea, but it's hard to do, especially now when no one knows what the coronavirus might do. Right now, it exists as a widespread yet not especially lethal outbreak, though some, like Buffett's friend Bill Gates, fear it is a once-in-a-century pathogen. President Donald Trump insists that political opponents are using the virus to destabilize his administration, and the Federal Reserve lowered its interest rates by 0.5 percentage point, driving the 10-year Treasury yield to a historically low level, in order to blunt its impact. It isn't worth debating any of this because the stock market tells us everything we need to know. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped by 12% for the week ended February 28th, and the S&P 500 Index and the NASDAQ Composite each lost 11%. It was the market's worst week since 2008, and the volatility this past week has also been extraordinary. That raises a key point. In the dark days of the credit crisis, the financial world was seemingly ending. Yet by March of 2009, the worst was over, and some people set themselves up to make fortunes because they bought stocks during those dark days. The great indicator that led them to buy when everyone else was selling was often their own discomfort. When the tape made them feel like they wanted to throw up from the stress, they bought stocks and sold bearish put options to buy stocks even lower. Others concluded that widespread interest in hedging stocks during the crisis, a sign of panic because it shows an insensitivity to price, suggested the market would stop declining. This isn't meant to imply the coronavirus will soon stop menacing the market. No one knows what will happen tomorrow, but if you invest today in a blue-chip stock, values may fluctuate, but your future investment will almost certainly be worth more, provided the virus doesn't destroy the world. Since the credit crisis, we have encouraged investors to practice time arbitrage by taking advantage of current conflagrations in anticipation of better tomorrows. If you can buy and hold for a few years, today's problems likely won't be so severe. To follow Buffett's fear dictum, consider the humble cash-secured put strategy, which entails selling puts on quality stocks while setting aside the purchase price of the underlying stock in your brokerage account. Find stocks that you can own for a few years or longer, and sell 1 to 3 month puts with strike prices that are just below the stock's price. Favor stocks like AT&T, symbol T, with a dividend yield of about 6%, or Verizon Communications, symbol VZ, with a yield of 4.5%. If the virus worsens, people will still speak on their mobile phones, surf the internet, and watch TV. Netflix, symbol NFLX, the king of streaming content, should do well too. The put strategy is simple. If the stock advances rather than declines, you keep the premium. If the stock is at the strike price at expiration, you buy the stock. The real risk is that the stock falls far below the put strike price, and investors must cover the put at a higher price or buy the stock at the strike price, even if it's trading lower. The strategy works for any stock you are willing to own until brighter days return. Our fear strategy is like disaster prepping. Rather than hoarding water, ammunition, and canned goods, you are stockpiling quality stocks that often pay attractive dividends when many investors are fearful. This isn't for everyone, naturally, but those who dare tend to win. And our article was titled, Be Like Warren Buffett in Times Like These, and Here's How, written by Stephen M. Sears for Barron's. And next, an investment we don't talk about too much. Gold is rising amid the swings in stocks. Here's Why the Rally Has Legs, written by Andrew Barry. Gold is living up to its reputation as a haven during turbulent times. The precious metal is up 10.5% this year to $1,673 an ounce, a 7-year high. It could be on its way to testing its record high of $1,900, set in 2011. Leading mining companies such as Newmont, ticker symbol NEM, and Barrick Gold, symbol GOLD, have bucked the recent slide in stocks and are each up about 15% this year. Bulls see more gains for bullion and the stocks, as investors around the world gravitate toward a sector in which most have little or no exposure. Gold is responding to systemic financial risk, says Joe Foster, a manager of the Van Eck International Investors Gold Fund, symbol INIVX. Foster argues that gold isn't simply an inflation hedge, as it was during the 1970s, but benefits more broadly from financial, geopolitical, and economic dislocations, including the impact of COVID-19. The flows into gold are just getting started, says Peter Grosskopf, chief executive of Sprott, a Toronto asset manager focused on precious metals. Gold is now being seen as mandatory portfolio insurance, not a fringe asset. He says that ownership of gold among institutional and retail investors remains low, with few even having Sprott's recommended asset allocation of 5%. Yielding nothing, gold often moves counter to the dollar, and often does well when real or inflation-adjusted interest rates are negative, as they are now. The real rate, for instance, on the 10-year Treasury is -1%, with consumer prices rising at a 2% rate. Jeffrey Gundlach, the CEO of DoubleLine, a major bond manager, told CNBC this past week that it is almost a certainty that gold will go to an all-time high versus the dollar. Gundlach, who has been bullish on gold since the metal stood at about $1,200 in 2018, sees a good chance that the Federal Reserve will cut short interest rates again, perhaps as soon as 2 weeks from now, following its surprise half-point cut this past week. The Fed is cutting rates, which is dollar negative, and that means gold is heading higher, Gundlach said. Barron's has been bullish on gold since a September 2018 cover story. There are many ways to play gold. Those who like gold but don't want the hassle of owning and storing it can choose from many exchange-traded funds. The largest bullion ETF is the $50 billion Spider Gold Trust, symbol GLD, followed by the iShares Gold Trust, symbol IAU, which has a slightly lower fee at 0.25% annually versus 0.4% for the Spider Gold Trust. There is a liquid options market on that ETF. Money has steadily flowed into gold bullion ETFs globally in the past month, and the sector now totals almost $150 billion. Mining stock ETFs are led by Van Eck Vectors Gold Miners, symbol GDX, and Van Eck Vectors Junior Gold Miners, symbol GDXJ. Today, big mining companies are focused on delivering rising free cash flow rather than increasing production, regardless of cost. Barrick is led by one of the industry's best executives, Mark Bristow, a swashbuckling South African who had headed Rand Gold, which merged with Barrick in early 2019. Newmont, which merged with North America rival Gold Corporation, Goldcorp, has the largest market value in the sector and is the only gold stock in the S&P 500 index. The industry, however, faces challenges, including the difficulty of finding new mines, as well as political and environmental opposition. Mining gold means crushing a ton of rock to obtain just a few grams of the metal. Even with the latest move, the Van Eck Vectors Gold Miners ETF is still only half of its 2011 peak, and many smaller mining stocks have trailed the largest companies. I don't think the stocks have ever been cheaper, Van Eck Foster says. They haven't responded to the gold prices as much as in the past. Barrick and Newmont may not look cheap, with both trading at about 25 estimated 2020 earnings. But Foster looks at mining companies based on a different metric, annual pre-tax cash flow. He says the stocks trade for 7 to 8 times pre-tax cash flow against a historical average of around 11. The mining companies also offer optionality, meaning that their earnings rise at a multiple of an increase in gold prices. At a time of growing financial risks and shrinking interest rates around the world, it is time for gold to find a place in investors' portfolios. And that was Gold is Rising Amid the Swings in Stocks. Here's Why the Rally Has Legs, written by Andrew Barry, who writes for Barron's. And with what is actually this week's Barron's cover story, we have this article, also written by Andrew Barry. What stocks should you be buying right now? These 12 have high dividend yields for market turmoil. The sharp drop in bond yields has heightened the appeal of stocks with high dividends, and the recent sell-off in the stock market has created plenty of them. There were 55 stocks in the S&P 500 index with dividend yields of 5% or higher at the close of trading on Thursday. More joined the club after the market drop on Friday. Our list includes well-known companies like Altria Group, symbol MO, Chevron, symbol CVX, ExxonMobil, symbol XOM, AT&T, symbol T, ABV, symbol ABBV, Prudential Financial, symbol PRU, Dow, symbol DOW, and Wells Fargo, symbol WFC. With the 10-year Treasury note hitting a record low yield of 0.7% on Friday, and with the 10-year top-grade municipal bonds well below 1%, these dividend yields look attractive in comparison. Risk does come with high dividend yields, however. Many investors view high-yielding stocks as value traps rather than opportunities. Cornerstone macro strategist Michael Kantrovitz wrote recently that high dividend stocks haven't derived much benefit from declining interest rates over the past 15 years and have seen their weighting in the S&P 500 steadily decline. Stocks with high dividends sometimes have far worse fundamentals than peers, he wrote. Yes, investors need to be careful. But the dividends on this dozen companies look secure based on payout ratios, using projected 2020 earnings, the strength of their balance sheets, and the durability of their businesses. An indicator of dividend strength is a company's bond yield. One encouraging sign for the dozen is that dividend yields comfortably exceed the yields on each company's debt. This wide gap in favor of dividends indicates that equity investors may be overly concerned about dividend safety. One area that is vastly oversold is energy, says Charles Lieberman, the chief investment officer at Advisors Capital Management in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Investors have been burned, and retail investors are fleeing. Energy stocks took another beating on Friday, as West Texas Intermediate crude fell $4.38 to $41.50 a barrel. The Energy Select Sector Spider exchange-traded fund, symbol XLE, which is dominated by Exxon and Chevron, was down 5.5% to $42.50 after falling to its lowest level since the financial crisis. Lieberman is partial to a group of energy pipeline companies, including Kinder Morgan, symbol KMI, an industry leader whose shares trade around $20 and yield 5%. Pipeline operators carry less risk from lower energy prices than do producers because of their contracts to carry oil products and natural gas. Kinder Morgan is more of a tolling company, says Michael Jameson, a manager director at Griffin Asset Management in New York. The economics of the contracts don't change when energy prices change. Kinder Morgan's payout ratio based on reported earnings is above 100%, but is about 50% based on its discretionary cash flow. Kinder Morgan is projecting a 25% increase in its dividend in 2020 to $1.25 a share. Exxon hit a 15-year low of $48 on Friday, and now yields over 7%, its highest yield in more than 30 years. Exxon's payout ratio is above 100%, a warning sign, after it took on about $9 billion in debt during 2019 to help pay its dividend. With a AAA bond rating from Moody's and still modest debt relative to cash flow and rock-bottom borrowing costs, Exxon can borrow for a while to fund its dividend if energy prices stay low. The company not only backed the dividend at its investor day this past week, but stated that it remained committed to a reliable and growing dividend. Exxon has a record of 37 consecutive years of dividend increases. Another could come in April, when it does typically lift its dividend. The oil giant, however, is more stretched than any of its major peers, given its high capital spending as part of a program to increase energy production by about 25% by 2025. investors are uncomfortable with that. The historically defensive stock is now the worst performer in the Dow Jones Industrial Average this year, with a 32% decline. Exxon's dividend break-even, the Brent crude price at which it covers its dividend from free cash flow, is above $80 a barrel, against under $60 for Chevron, ConocoPhillips, symbol COP, Royal Dutch Shell, symbol RDS.B, and BP, symbol BP. Brent finished on Friday at $45 a barrel. Shares of Exxon remain disliked by some analysts, but they could be near a bottom, as they trade for a small premium to book value. If Exxon is right and demand for fossil fuels continues to rise over the next 20 years, the company could be in a great position in a few years, having higher production and gaining market share from its rivals. Chevron, whose shares are off 21% this year to $95, covers its dividend more comfortably. It now stands at 5.4%. Next to energy, financial stocks have been the worst performers in the stock market this year, as investors anticipate weaker bank earnings. The sharp drop in rates is the main culprit pressuring net interest margins. Bank earnings could be lower in 2020 than in 2019, but that is reflected in the stocks, which are down an average of 25% so far this year. With the decline, some banks like Wells Fargo, whose shares are off 30% this year to $37, and Comerica, symbol CMA, at $45, both yield over 5%. Other major banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase, symbol JPM, Bank of America, symbol BAC, and Citigroup, symbol C, yield about 3%. We believe bank dividends are safe, Jason Goldberg, the Barclays banking analyst, emailed Barron's on Friday. While bank earnings will be adversely impacted by the sudden drop in interest rates, it is important to note that the industry enters its period of uncertainty from a position of strength, with record capital and liquidity and benign asset quality trends. Banks, he notes, are subject to a far more adverse economic and financial scenario in the annual stress tests administered by the Federal Reserve than what's likely from the coronavirus. The extreme stress scenario envisions an 8% drop in gross domestic product from peak levels and a 10% unemployment rate against 3.5% in February. The Wells Fargo yield is very safe, Jameson says. The new CEO, Charles Scharf, will clean house. It's a great franchise, and it will become more consumer-friendly. A major mortgage lender, Wells Fargo should also benefit from the drop in rates. AbbVie, which is due to complete its merger with Allergan in the coming months, trades around $89 and yields 5.3%, among the highest dividends in the drug group. It has a comfortable payout ratio of about 50% based on its projected 2020 earnings of about $9.67 a share. Dow, the chemicals producer, has been hit hard along with other economically sensitive stocks, falling 29% this year to $40. It yields 7% and has a high payout ratio of 81% based on projected 2020 earnings of $3.49 a share. Dow is committed to what it calls an industry-leading dividend. Howard Ungerleiter, its president and chief financial officer, called it the company's number one priority for free cash flow on an earnings conference call in January. AT&T, whose shares at $37 yield 5.6%, has a manageable payout ratio below 60%. The company is sufficiently comfortable with its outlook to increase its share repurchase program under pressure from activist hedge fund Elliott Management. Altria, known for its Marlboro cigarettes, has taken a write-down of about 60% on its Juul Labs stake, but that shouldn't affect its ability to pay the dividend. At $43, Altria now yields 8%. The company takes its dividend very seriously. It has lifted it 54 times in the past half century, including a 5% increase last year. The top U.S. cigarette maker targets an 80% dividend payout ratio. Given the high yield, some investors would like to see Altria forego a dividend increase this year or raise the quarterly payout, now 84 cents, by just a penny, to buy back more stock. Like other life insurers, Prudential Financial has been hit by the decline in interest rates, which may pressure earnings as maturing bond holdings have to be reinvested at lower yields. The company has one of the highest yields of its peers and a comfortable payout ratio of under 40%. Its shares at about $70 yield over 6%. Investors can also play high-yielding stocks through many ETFs, including the Vanguard High Dividend Yield, symbol VYM, Spider S&P Dividend, symbol SDY, and Schwab U.S. Dividend Equity, symbol SCHD, all yielding more than 3%. Many investors now prefer lower-yielding stocks with safer dividends. But there is still a place for high yielders if investors are selective in their choices. And our cover story for this week is titled, What Stocks Should You Buy Right Now? These 12 have high dividend yields for market turmoil. And it was written by Andrew Barry for Barron's. And while we're on the subject of yields, let's shift over to the February issue of Kiplinger's Personal Finance, where we find Jeffrey Kosnet's income investing column, and the title is Taxable Munis, They're Worth a Look. To herald this new decade, I decree that we quit bemoaning the Great Recession and credit crisis of 2008-2009 and its many calamities. It happened. It was costly. We learned something about defaults and diversification, and it's old news. But before we lock the door on those dark days, I offer a shout-out to one of the meltdown's few rewarding legacies, the taxable municipal bond. Yes, there is such a thing. A handful are general obligation bonds issued by municipalities, but the vast majority are construction or infrastructure bonds issued and backed by a public entity. Some 15% of fresh state and local debt today pays interest subject to federal income taxes, and the yields to maturity are considerably higher than treasuries or regular municipals, often over 3% for 15-year bonds or 5% for 20-year debt. In 2019, taxable muni issuance spiked amid high demand, and that has carried into 2020 because of the hunt for yield and these bonds' powerful appeal for IRAs, pension funds, and foreign buyers who would gain no advantage from tax freeze anyway. Overseas demand is often the trigger for issuers to add a smaller taxable portion to a large tax-exempt offering. After all, a 3.2% 15-year bond rated A+ and backed by, say, an international airport's terminal and parking revenue is an easy sell in negative yield Europe. Taxable muni issuers have recently included the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, the Multnomah County, Oregon, which is in the Portland area, school district, and several state college and university systems. Sound describes the credit quality, but it doesn't do justice to the performance of these bonds. Standard & Poor's Taxable Municipal Index has returned 12.9% over the past year, compared with 8.1% for the comparable S&P Long-Term Tax-Free Index and 10.8% for the broad bond market yardstick, the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate. Vanguard's broadest taxable bond exchange-traded fund, BND, made 10.9%, which is sweet but not as spectacular as taxable muni returns. Lest you dismiss these munis as a one-year wonder, the 10-year annualized gain for that S&P taxable muni index is 6.5%, which beat the 5.3% from an index of bonds issued by firms in the S&P 500 index, a fair comparison of high-grade taxable issuers. The engines for continued impressive returns are the fundamentals, which include more compelling yields than other taxable debt, comparable or superior credit ratings, and, as Baird Municipal's maven and portfolio manager Dwayne McAllister puts it, the security of knowing you are lending to public institutions rather than to corporations that are subject to industry cycles or laboring under high or questionable debt burdens. Recession, as always, is a risk, but where's the recession? Not seeing it, friends. And remember, this was written before February, but he's probably still not seeing a real recession. Taxable munis also benefit from being mostly non-callable, unlike corporate bonds. Although some are slated to be refinanced on a fixed schedule, you can assume the attractively high coupon will survive 10 years or longer. Jason Audette, who manages separate municipal accounts for Appleton Partners, calls the design a low-risk, high-income anomaly. Though I often espouse owning individual muni bonds, there are a few of these I would reject, such as debts backed by nursing homes and minor league baseball parks. Fund investors can consider the Invesco Taxable Municipal ETF, symbol BAB, tracking the performance of a U.S. taxable muni debt index, and two closed-end funds, BlackRock Taxable Municipal Bond Trust, symbol BBN, and Nuveen Taxable Municipal Income Fund, symbol NBB. The closed-end's active management has given them an edge, and both are remarkably priced below net asset value. And that article was titled Taxable Munis, They Are Worth a Look, written by Jeffrey Cosnett for the February issue of Kiplinger's. And that is all of personal investing for today. I hope you enjoyed it, our little update there, and that you'll be with us next time. You can listen to Personal Investing on Thursdays at 1 p.m., on Saturday mornings at 5:30 a.m., and Sundays at 10 p.m. Listen anytime by logging on to virginiavoice.org. I'm Bob McKeever for the Virginia Voice.